Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Celine DaCosta, author of The Burning Ground, One Woman's Journey to Reclaim Her Soul and Ignite Her Fire. Celine DaCosta is an author, speaker, and master coach who guides visionary leaders to live, lead, and express themselves in full alignment with their soul's truth. Her latest book is The Burning Ground. Raised between Italy, Brazil, and the United States, she is a woman of many worlds. At 25, she left behind a promising corporate career to follow a deeper call, one that led her to travel across more than 70 countries, couch surf with strangers around the globe, and explore the depths of the human spirit. Today, Celine blends subconscious reprogramming, communication, storytelling, intuition training, and emotional mastery to help high-achieving professionals embody their most authentic and magnetic leadership. Her work has supported Fortune 150 executives, entrepreneurs, and changemakers in more than 60 countries. And her insights have been featured in Forbes, Entrepreneur, Business Leader, and her TEDx talk on the power of human connection. She now divides her time between the Mediterranean and South America, where she continues to write, coach, and explore what it means to come home to oneself. The journey doesn't end here. Visit CelineDaCosta.com for ways to keep going. And that website is Celine, CelineDaCosta.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Celine to the show. Good day, Celine.
Hello, good day, good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you. I'm very happy to hear your story and kind of light a fire in some of my listeners as well. So let's start with the idea that, you know, you left behind everything, your career, your apartment, your relationship, and couch surf, like I had said, and with more than 70 plus strangers. But you have said that you weren't running away. What were you actually looking for then?
So, yes, I love this question because a lot of times when people are doing like really, really big life changes, there is a bit of, am I avoiding? Am I distracting from? Am I running away? And I'm not saying that it was 0% running away. Definitely there were elements of that. But really the driving force behind me taking this journey was a deep, deep soul calling to discover who I really am in this world and what the nature of humanity and reality actually is. And it sounds like such a big feat for a 25-year-old, but here's the catch, Robert. I didn't actually know that's what I was doing. You know, hindsight is 20/20, and looking back now, over a decade later, I can beautifully articulate what 25-year-old me was attempting to do on this journey. But back then, I didn't have the language. I didn't know what I was doing. I did not have the templates, the frameworks, the model, the knowledge that I have today. I had no idea that I was going through a spiritual awakening. I did not know what the term soul even meant. But that's exactly what was happening. And I'm sure, you know, for yourself or anyone who's listening, have you had a moment where you have this overwhelming urge, like from deep, deep, deep inside of you, where you felt you were compelled towards something and you felt you had to do it, but you couldn't rationally explain why? Have you had that yourself?
Oh yes. And it can be frustrating if you don't know why.
Yes, it's so frustrating because the mind wants an answer. The mind wants facts. The mind wants to actually be able to explain what the heck is going on. And for many of us, especially those who, you know, have spent a lot of time in the Western world, we've been heavily conditioned to be mind first instead of soul first. And so for me, it was a completely confusing experience on the surface, you know, like when I think about the ocean and I think about the turbulent waters and the storms that come in the, and at the top of the water. But when you go deep, deep, deep under the waves, there's actually this deep calm, this deep knowing. And that's what I was experiencing when I left on this journey, was this deep, like, I need to change my life. There's something bigger that's waiting for me out there. And it didn't feel like I was running away from something. It actually felt like I was running towards something.
Yeah, and something that you just did not know what that something was.
I had zero idea, like no freaking idea. And it was the most frustrating thing ever.
I bet. So now, with you not knowing, what about the people around you, you know, the people who were in your circle, what were their thoughts about you kind of going on this adventure where you don't have answers for?
Goodness gracious, that's a really good one, because I think, you know, I'll share with you my micro answer, but behind my micro answer is also a macro insight, okay, which is that when you make a decision to do something really big in your life that is completely out of your comfort zone, that is completely outside of everything that you have known, you can expect to receive some kind of pushback, because the people around you are used to the version of you that you've always been. That's who they're conditioned to know. Like the story of Celine, the story of Robert, the people in your circle only know you to be who you've ever been. And so when you're like, okay, I'm going to, you know, for me, when I've been a very hardworking, put my head down, get straight A's, go to university, get honors, now go to my job, do the thing, and immigrant working in America, and I'm just working really hard for the promotion, and that's what my identity has been built around. And then I have this, you know, from the outside looking in, crazy decision. I'm just going to leave it all behind. I'm going to quit my job. I have no idea how I'm going to make any money. I just know I'm going to do a one-way trip around the world. And by the way, I'm going to sleep in the homes of complete strangers. Like, I'm a small young woman, and I'm just going to throw myself in there, right? People are like, what the F? What are you doing? Like, it's so outside of any identity that anyone has ever known. So inevitably, I had a lot of pushback. You know, as you can imagine, my mom freaked out. My dad did not freak out as much, because he's a world traveler, and he spent, you know, his 20s traveling, backpacking through India without a phone, before phones were a thing and maps were paper. So, you know, I had my dad who was like, okay, this is a little weird, but I can support you. My mom's like, oh my God, my baby girl, her safe. What are we going to do? You're going to, the safety. And then everything in between, you know, I had friends who were like, oh, holy crap, you are in for the most epic adventure of your life. Like, I can't wait to see what happens for you. And then there were other friends who were like, are you sure? Like, have you made a plan B? How are you going to eat? Like, what about money? Like, what about your safety? And so there was this huge spectrum of opinions, which honestly, now that I look back, were just a massive mirror for all the kinds of different thoughts that I was having about whether I would be okay, because there was nothing that anyone said to me that I hadn't already worried about. There was nothing that someone fretted about that I hadn't personally felt anxious or fearful of. And so it goes back to, you know, the microcosm was, yes, there was a lot of people that thought I was nuts in like a dangerous way. And there was people who thought I was nuts in the coolest way. And there were people who had zero, were not worried about me. They knew that I was going to make it through. And then there was me and my decision, and knowing that deep inside, this is what I have to do. I had to have this experience. And I think it's important to share that, because a lot of times when anyone, you know, yourself or anyone who's listening, you're going through a really big life transition and you're about to change things up in an enormous way, it is expected to actually like receive some kind of pushback. But when we start to receive the pushback as a mirror of our own thoughts or our own fears and our own anxieties, it leaves us feeling more resourced to continue to go within and ask our soul, what is it that I need to do? And that's the only voice I answer to, is my soul. And that took some time to filter through, to recognize, and to reclaim.
Yeah. Now, in your travels, the people with whom you stayed, seem to, in a way, be living vicariously through your adventure. So tell us a little bit about that, because there are a lot of people who wouldn't do it themselves, but love the idea and, you know, the ability to maybe experience some of the excitement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So think about it this way. Why do thousands or tens of thousands of people gather around a stadium to watch athletes throw a ball around? Like, why do we do this? Why do so many, why is entertainment, the entertainment industry, one of the greatest, you know, industries profit-wise and in the world? Well, we are wired, we love to remember what the human spirit can do. It does something inside of us when we see a world-class athlete perform an incredible feat that we know that perhaps ourselves we can never do, but we can live through their achievements to remember what the human spirit can actually do when we train, when we focus, when we remember. And now I'm not by any way, shape, or form comparing myself to a world-class athlete, but what I did was incredibly unconventional and incredibly out of the box, and it was something that many people dream of doing but just don't have the flexibility, the ability, the resources, or, you know, the courage, whatever it is to do. And also to be clear, I don't think that many people dream to, like, travel the world and sleep in the homes of strangers. I think that could be possibly many people's worst case nightmare. But it wasn't about what I was doing, Robert. It wasn't about, like, the actual act of me sleeping in people's couches. What I believe this was about was the act of saying no to a life that I had been conditioned into and trapped into, and saying yes to living the truth of my spirit. I think that is what people were attracted to, was, oh my gosh, I'm trapped. I feel conditioned. I feel like I have a dream and I'm not going after it all the way. And I'm not doing the uncomfortable things that I know I'm meant to be doing. And I'm not following the voice of my intuition. And so to see someone who was doing that was an inspiring experience, and it was something that they were able to calibrate to. I can't tell you how many people whose homes I stayed in, who told me, literally said to my face, like, the reason why I said yes to hosting you in my house, even though you're a complete stranger, is because I wanted to, like, actually understand and to support. I wanted to support and understand someone who's following their dreams and they're doing it in such a courageous way, because I want to see what that's all about. And I can't tell you how many times, weeks or months after I left their homes, I would get a text message or an email with somebody who would tell me, thank you so much for inspiring me. You know, I left that relationship that was toxic. I quit my job. I went after that dream. Like, I did it. I took a step towards what it is that I was meant to do. And so to wrap it all up with that, this one, Robert, it's that what I believe is that when we have the courage to pursue our dreams and we really say yes to life, yes to soul, the very act of us authentically, like, pursuing that dream is going to, first of all, magnetize people towards us that want to support our dream, because when they support my dream, they support what I stand for, which is the reclamation of our soul and reigniting our inner fire. And when they support my dream, then by osmosis, they are actually receiving the courage, receiving the codes for them to go after what it is that they want to do. So it's really such a powerful way. When we support other people's visions, we are supporting our own vision, because ultimately we are one. And that's how we walk each other home, is we help each other get to where we want to be. And if that place is soul aligned, then the good of that soul is the good of all souls. That's what I believe.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I agree. Now, I want to talk about just a few of the stops along the way. One, that you began with a connection in San Diego that you indicate in your book changed everything. So can you tell us what happened?
What happened in which way?
I believe it wasn't in you know, the idea of couch surfing and someone you didn't know, and it was just like a connection of a friend, I believe, maybe, for San Diego. And so it seems like that may have been an example for you. To this is what I want to do.
I get it. So basically, how did it start? Where did the idea come from?
Right.
So here's what happened. And of course, you know, my book, The Burning Ground, is gonna in detail give you a sequence of like the events of what actually happened that led me up to making this decision. The very grand synopsis is that I had a series of events happen in my life that shook me awake to the fact that it led me to the breaking point, or the, you know, the breakthrough point, where I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, I need to change my life and I need to do it now. The moment that decision was made, there was a sequence of events that were put in motion by no other than the universe, God's grace. Like, I can't tell you how it happened, but what I know is that there's a phenomenon that happens that when you make a decision and that decision is in alignment to your soul's greater calling, the reality starts to rearrange itself to support you to make that decision. And it shows up not necessarily as, hey, you just manifested all the money that you needed to go on the trip, or you just manifested, you know, the job opportunity you've been searching for years. Like, it happens like that, but it also happens in the form of things falling apart. So the breakup, the rent hike that you weren't expecting. For me, it was also a promotion that I was sure I was going to get and didn't get. And so there was a sequence of events that led me to feel very discombobulated in my life and very disoriented. And in that disorientation, one of the things that happened is that I was meant to travel. I had a boyfriend at the time. We broke up the day before my birthday, which is October 21st. And I had a trip already with tickets, plane tickets already paid for December to San Diego, which is a city that I always wanted to go. And then a few weeks before that, I had also a trip to Austin. Now, the tickets were paid, but the agreement was that, you know, because of my job at the time, I was a junior in advertising, he was going to support with the hotel rooms and everything. Like, he was taking me there. Well, because we're no longer together, I had plane tickets, but I didn't really have financially the means to go on, you know, the grand trip that I wanted to go on. So I started to get really creative. And I said, you know what? What if, you know, I've gone to places before and I've stayed in rooms, in homes of people. What if you find someone in Austin and then find someone in San Diego that would be happy to like have me as a guest for a few days? Like, I can make that work, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I just started asking around, and lo and behold, I found a friend of a friend who knew, who had a, you know, went to university with somebody who was in Austin, connected me, and the woman was like, sure, like, I'd be happy to host you, you know? So I went to Austin and I had a great time with this woman, and I had a great time like traveling by myself in Austin. And I realized and saw how I just had such a great time. And by then I hadn't done a lot of solo travel. And then a month later I went to San Diego, and oof, San Diego is where the needle really shifted for me, because the woman I was connected to, she wasn't just like, hey, yeah, come to my house, crash on my couch. She was like, when is your plane arriving? I'm going to pick you up. And this woman picks me up. And from the moment that she picks me up, we just soul sisters, you know, and she's gone through a breakup. Her and I are having completely parallel lives. We can't believe the coincidences. You know, we're hanging out, we're going to the park in San Diego. We're just inseparable for 3 days, and I just had the most amazing time staying with this woman. And I think to myself, goodness gracious, I could have never replicated this if I was at a hotel. Like, what an amazing heart-opening experience. And so this experience was in December. This was 6 months before I actually got on a plane and left. And it planted a seed, because at the time I wasn't like, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to travel. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I was trying to figure out how to get my butt over to Europe, and like, I was just trying to figure it out. And then it dawned on me after having this experience, I thought to myself, crazy idea. What if I do this, but everywhere on the planet? Because my interaction with Jackie, this woman, it wasn't just a pleasant travel experience. It healed something inside of me. It was a healing experience for my heart. And it renewed my faith in humanity. That was just a drop. And so I realized maybe there's a way that I can travel around the world, that I can do it. Because, you know, also finances was a big concern for me. I was quitting my job. Mm-hmm. And I had some savings, but I'm like, how the heck am I going to travel around the world? This is going to cost me so much. I don't even think I can do it. And so I thought, well, if I just start talking to people, which is what I love to do anyway, and I start sharing about this dream that I have to discover my life's purpose, and I just start having this experience again and again and again, I can do that. And why not? And so that planted a seed that started to become watered. And in the book, you know, I share a story about one of my best friends and how she actually was the tipping point of how I went from, I don't know, this is a crazy idea, to like, this is the only way. This is the only path for me. But I hit that tipping point and I realized, yes, I can do this. It's going to change my life and it's going to lead me into the next chapter of who I'm here to be. So that's how I got started.
Yeah. And with that friend, it seems that the plan B became plan A, correct?
Oh my God. That's so funny because that's literally what, there's a chapter in my book, chapter two. And that's literally what she said to me that changed everything. That's really funny you say it exactly like that. Because I was telling her, I was having a drink with her. This was February, it's 2 months. And I said to her, Natalie, because she was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, no, at the time I was interviewing for these big tech companies in Europe. And I was flying over and I had just flown back from Dublin. And I was like, you know, this is a really big opportunity. It pays really well. And I'll be in Europe, so maybe I can travel in Europe. And I'm just kind of trying to convince her of why I should take a better paying, more prestigious job, but in Europe. And she's looking at me like she's not sold at all. And then I'm like, you know what? Or here's a crazy idea. And I just said, just joking, half joking. I'm like, why don't I just say fuck it to all of this? And, you know, I get my backpack. I get a one-way ticket, I start traveling around the world, and I sleep in people's homes, and I just start talking to them and interviewing them and, like, understanding what the human condition is and just writing about that on the internet. Oh, like, how crazy would that be? Right? Like, half laughing at myself. And she looks at me, and she has these piercing blue eyes. Like, she's so powerful. She's the kind of woman that stops you in your tracks when she walks into a room, right? She looks at me, and she's like, Celine, I think your plan B is your plan A. And I'm here, you know, just you go do your thing, but I'm here for when you're ready to realize that, you know? And that was the tipping point for me that made me realize that I had to do the crazy thing. That was the only path for me. I was not going to go the safe route.
There you go. Now, there was another experience that you had that it seemed to me to be kind of shift your perspective in a deep way, and that was your teaching experience with the children in Cambodia. Can you tell us, you know, a little bit about that experience and what shift in you was a result of that?
So Robert, what I'll share with you as a disclaimer is I'm originally from Italy and I'm actually half Brazilian. And I share this because I am no stranger to being exposed to poverty. And, you know, ever since I was little, like, thank goddess, I had many privileges in my life in the way that I was able to grow up thanks to my parents' efforts. But, you know, my mother, she grew up in a very different context than I did as my grandparents. And it was really important to my mother as I was growing up, as a little girl, for me to be exposed to what was happening in the world, right? She would take me to orphanages. She would take me to the favelas in Brazil. Those are the low income places for me to really like have a reality check on what is going on in the world and how other people are living. And so I already had that imprint in my system. And so through the grace of God, which again, I share a bit more about in the book, I had a travel blog when I was in New York that I just kept for fun. Somehow a known author saw a post that I did. He was really touched by it. We got on a call. He was really touched by my story. And he offered to sponsor a trip, a volunteer trip to Cambodia. This was while I was in my corporate job, where I would go to Cambodia and teach at an orphanage and write about my experience. And so I did that. I took my, 2 weeks off a year and I went to Cambodia. And as I said, I had known poverty in terms of, you know, being exposed to certain environments in Brazil, but I had not known poverty like this. it was a shock to my system to see how much worse it could get from the things I had already seen, which I thought were already pretty bad. And as I was, you know, supporting these incredible children and just seeing, and, you know, for anyone who doesn't know much about Cambodia, they had a very brutal genocide not too long ago in the 90s. And so I would be meeting locals, and pretty much everybody that I met, Robert, had an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, like, that mm-hmm. was slaughtered, like, not just murdered, but slaughtered.
No.
Oh, God. And there was just that the death camps, you know, I had the experience of going to these mass graves. And again, the fact that it was mm-hmm. literally happening when I was a child makes it not like, you know, you go to World War II and you're like, yeah, that is so horrible, but it was so long ago. It's right. in the past, it's history. But this didn't feel like history. This felt like a very present human condition. And so I was incredibly rattled by that experience. And not only that, the day that I landed in Cambodia, which I also share about in my book, my grandfather, who I just absolutely looked up to and loved so dearly, he passed away literally day one that I'm there. So my heart's already split open. And then I'm being exposed to this horrific history that this beautiful country carries. And I remember on my last night, it was a Saturday night, and, you know, we had finished our training, and I was walking with a friend in the streets of Phnom Penh, which is the capital of Cambodia. And, you know, there was a lot of drinking. There was a lot of, like, people. You could tell, you know, the streets are just rattled with Westerners, super drunk on, and I don't know on what else. And you're walking down the streets, and you're seeing these young women who are most definitely children in these very provocative clothes. And you can put two and two together. Like, you know what's happening when an older Western man is approaching a young woman that is, you know, clantily, like,
mm-hmm.
she's not wearing many clothes, you know? And so yeah. I'm kind of walking through the streets, and I'm feeling this really big sickness in my stomach because I just spent 2 weeks with these kids who, like, don't have parents, whose parents were freaking brutally murdered. And I'm just so rattled already, and I'm seeing this, and I'm feeling sick to my stomach, and I'm walking home, and I remember taking the street, and it's just, the whole street is lined with cardboard boxes, and on those cardboard boxes are children, not adults, but children that are sleeping. And as I remember this one particular scene that I don't think I could ever erase from my mind, I see this little girl, like two years old, like waddling, and she's like waddling into the street, and this teenager, who is her caretaker, I'm guessing, she, like, runs after her, picks her up, and brings her back onto a cardboard box. And I just see this teenage girl kind of like protecting this little two-year-old girl on a cardboard box in the middle of a really busy street in Cambodia, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what are we doing? What are we, like, why is this, like, oh, God, I get upset even thinking about it. Like, why is this reality? And I'm thinking to myself, I can't live the life I'm living. It's like, I don't feel like I'm doing anything in the world to even support, like, to even, like, remotely, like, shift anything in this reality. And so I flew back the next day to New York, and I just was not the same person. I couldn't see the world. It was like something got stripped, a veil got peeled back, and I looked at the same world that I had been living in for years, and I'm like, I cannot participate in this. I have to live a life that is, you know, I don't have to save the world, and I don't have to go on a mission to save the children, but I also cannot, like, live my days feeling like I'm existing and not contributing to something greater than myself. And so I didn't know what that was going to be, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. And for whatever freaking reason, this trip was the way that I started it. And this book is the way that I get to pass it forward. And I don't know why, but it does feel like what I was supposed to do.
Yeah. It seems so. Definitely. Now, there was also an experience in Hawaii where you kind of had what some people may have worried that your activities may bring up someone, like in this case, it was Creepy Kyle. And so tell us a little bit about the Hawaii experience, because it provided some golden nuggets for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So context around the Hawaii experience without giving it away, because obviously you'll have to read my book. But one of the main themes in my book was my relationship with the masculine. And it was, you know, I share a bit about a couple instances in my childhood around betrayal with men, with my stepfather. And the trauma, straightforward, like the trauma that I had around trusting my caregivers and specifically trusting men. And what I, one of the biggest gifts from this journey, and this is something that I also share about more in the book, is that when you step outside of your comfort zone and you decide to follow your soul's calling, like if it was all you had to do, Robert, then why is not everybody doing it? Why don't we all just do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we are afraid of so many things, both because of conditioning or our past or like what our ancestry, what our caregivers like passed on to us. But as a whole, humans are very afraid of the unknown. We're very afraid of the unknown. We are afraid of losing our identity and everything we have known. There is a sensational fear around being uncomfortable, the sensation of discomfort. So a lot of people, we don't step outside of their comfort zone because they're afraid of what they'll find on the other side. And they don't trust that what they're going to find on the other side is better than what they're leaving behind, what they worked so hard to leave behind. And so part of the less pretty, the more messy journey of stepping across that threshold into the unknown. And for my case, it was, literally going on this physical journey that I went on, is that in the process of going on this journey and changing my identity and changing who I am and realigning towards a deeper calling, I had to reckon with old parts of me, right? Like one of the biggest things I had to reckon with is I'm trying to freaking sleep in the homes of strangers or friends of friends or whatever, people I essentially don't know, but I don't trust people. That was the biggest thing for me. I don't trust people. I thought people, when I left, you wouldn't recognize it. You wouldn't believe it because I thought people are going to take advantage of you. Those are my belief systems were. People are going to take advantage of you. Men are definitely looking for something if they're being nice to you. And it was a whole list. It was like people are nice and then they turn on you, like a whole freaking list of identity and beliefs. And for whatever reason, my soul chose that I was going to put myself in the kind of exposure therapy in a kind of situation that would force me to reckon with those beliefs. And I don't want to lie here. It was fucking uncomfortable. It was very uncomfortable. And the book shares some of those incredibly uncomfortable, I just want to die and like crawl in a hole. Like how the heck is this happening moments. And one of those moments was in Hawaii. A lot of people ask me like, I slept in the trip in my book. I slept in homes of over 70 strangers. But what I don't share is that I kept unofficially going beyond the 9 months, and I have actually slept in the homes of hundreds of strangers, not just 70. It was 70 within that 9 month experiment. Mm-hmm. But in the hundreds of homes that I slept on, I really have only one experience where I felt I had to immediately get out. And that was the Hawaii experience. Now, without going too much into detail, there was a man that was one of my hosts, and he, there was a lot of red flags that I was not speaking into. I was ignoring them as I have done my whole life. Red flag number one, red flag number two, like red flag number three. And it came to the point where this man really overstepped my boundaries. And it became very clear to me that if I didn't get out of that situation, something irreversible would happen. And so the act of me getting out of the situation was the act of me reclaiming my power, because a past version of me would have stayed quiet and I would have just, quote unquote, taken it. I would have kind of like shied and squirreled away or like made myself smaller. But in this instance, I was faced with a crossroads, and I realized that if I really wanted to change the woman I was becoming and to step into my power and to also like be the one who protects me, I had to walk away from the situation, even though it was socially incredibly uncomfortable and rude, you could say. I had to do it. And the act of me doing that broke a big pattern of the ways that I would shrink in my power when men would abuse their power. Yeah. And so the Hawaii chapter was one of the many instances of the book where I was faced with a crossroads of like, you can either keep doing what you've always been doing and repeat the past, or you can do what you committed to doing, which is you're going to step away from this situation, even though it is so freaking uncomfortable and it goes against the way you were conditioned and the way that you have been doing things, and you're going to do something very, very different. And in the moment that you do it different, Robert, that's when the pattern breaks. And you do it different again, and a pattern breaks again. And you do it again, and the pattern breaks again. And so that's how we get to break old patterns that don't serve us, whether those patterns are of abuse or being small or holding back our voice. We can only do it by doing it and doing it repeatedly until the new way becomes the normal way.
Yeah. And with that change, you know, standing up for yourself, you also then learned the healing process of Ho'oponopono and also recognized your ability to have a career in coaching.
Yes, 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 absolutely, absolutely. So one of the most beautiful things about this, just traveling and being open to life while you're seeing the world, which is how I was, is that every single place that I went, I picked up a part of myself. And, you know, in the foreword, my dear friend Danielle Page, she wrote a beautiful foreword for me in this book. And I didn't even remember what I said that I said to her until I read it in her words that I shared with her once, that I went on a treasure hunt around the world to recollect myself whole. And I was like, wow, I really said that. That is such a cool thing. So I'm quoting myself. I'm quoting myself, not knowing that, not remembering that I had said it. But I think it's such a beautiful way to say it, because in every single place that I went, I picked up a part of me that was mine all along, but I just didn't know it was mine until I recognized it in someone else, right? And so I would have conversations with every host, and they would say something, or they would demonstrate something. And when they spoke it, or when they made a comment about me and how they perceived me, or when I noticed myself responding to them and how I was around them, I realized, oh my God, this is who I really am. I am sweet. I am kind. I am caring. I am smart. I am these things, you know? And so one of the things I realized was I met a beautiful woman who was local. She, you know, her ancestry, she comes from very ancient lines of Hawaii. And I had read about Ho'oponopono before, and I had seen things on the internet about Ho'oponopono before, but it's one thing to read about it, you know, second or third hand. Mm-hmm. But it is a completely different thing to receive the teachings straight from the source. Mm-hmm. And so to hear this woman, you know, especially after, like, imagine this, you know, I have this experience and I'm so fucking scared and I'm just rattled. And finally, you know, I am able to remove myself from something that really evoked a PTSD reaction within me. And how is it that 2 days later I end up in front of this beautiful Hawaiian woman who, without knowing the story, what I just went through, starts to speak to me about Ho'oponopono and the practice of forgiveness, and how in the past, you know, the villagers, they would have conflict and they would all need to come together and do a practice of Ho'oponopono so that the village could be in harmony and in synchrony. Mm-hmm. And it's the Ho'oponopono is, you know, I love you, I'm sorry, you know, please forgive me. And oh gosh, I forgot the fourth. How did I do that? Thank you. Yes, it's I love you. I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry. I love you. Thank you. Oh, sorry, I'm totally butchering. Anyway, I know that. I know it. But it's just like, it's about forgiveness, and it's about loving somebody and apologizing to them, even if they're the ones who did you wrong. And it's about thanking them for the lessons, for the opportunity, for the experience. And honoring them for the soul that they are, regardless of what happened in the 3D world. And so to receive this transmission was like, wow, it's in my power to forgive this person, but not because like I have something to, it's about, I'm not forgiving them for them. I'm forgiving them so I can set myself free to be who I want to be and have love in my heart. And being able to learn that through the one incident allowed me to actually expand that into the bigger incidents in my life. It was a pathway for me to stretch my capacity just a little bigger, for me to not only forgive one person who did one thing, but forgive someone in my past that did a lot of things, right? And so that was an incredible lesson. And then a few days later, it led me into a deep conversation with my host, where she was really struggling with different things in her life. Like, you know, she was feeling, she was from Brazil, so I had a deep connection with her, also because of my heritage. And she was struggling with her life. She felt so boxed. You know, she had traveled to Hawaii from Brazil, left her entire life behind, got married to the love of her life, and she felt so, so trapped and like, I don't know what to do. I feel like I don't have any money to go back home, and I don't know what to do because I, you know, graduated from university in Brazil, and here I don't have a diploma. And she was having all these issues and fears, Robert. And I naturally knew exactly what to say to her. I just knew, like, well, have you tried this? And what about this? And you know, have you forgiven this person in your life? And we had a two-hour conversation. Her husband walks in 2 hours in, and then I'm coaching him without even knowing what coaching was. And I'm speaking to him, and I'm helping them reconcile their relationship. And a few hours in, and they come back to each other. And I watch this couple, like, love each other and overcome their fears and overcome their beliefs. And I remember walking away from that experience feeling like, I just want to do this. This is what I want to do with my life. I just want to talk to people and help them, like, see their power and remember how incredible they are and flick away these belief systems and these fears. I want to do this every day. But I didn't have a word for it. I didn't know what coaching was. I literally didn't know what coaching was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be with people, and I want to help them overcome themselves so that they can remember who they are on a soul level. And I remember this woman, 3-4 months later, she sends me the most beautiful message. And she's like, that conversation changed my life. I am so happy I have you in my life. Like, here's what I've done in the last month. I applied for a green card. Like, we put our offer on a new house in this dream place that I wanted to go. I'm going on a silent retreat, you know, and she made all these changes in her life just from one conversation.
Wow.
And I realized, like, wow, there's so much power in, like, being present with someone and just seeing them and supporting them. Like, your life can change in just one conversation, and I want to be the person that has a conversation with that person whose life is going to change, right? Yeah. And that's what organically, naturally led me into coaching. And, you know, then life happened, and people started to approach me and ask me for more advice. And then someone one day introduced the word coach to me, and I was like, what's that? And I went on the internet and I looked up what that was. And I'm like, that's exactly what I want to do, you know? Yeah. And then another person asked me for advice. And then that person paid me money. And then they connected me to someone else who also paid me money. And then I realized, like, this is a career. And I organically, naturally was led into this beautiful vocation. And so, you know, a lot of people tell me, like, what made you want to become a coach? And I'm like, nothing did. It became me. Like, it wanted me. This industry wanted me. And I said, yes. So, and the book really, you know, shares in detail, like, how that happened. But it naturally, like, I was on a boat and I was downstream, and that boat led me to my coaching career.
Perfect. Now, your book deliberately doesn't end with a neat resolution, and you refuse to tie it up with a bow. So
yes.
why is that important, do you feel?
Yes. So I remember when I was already in the middle of my journey, I had a couple of people come up to me and they said, like, you have to read Eat, Pray, Love. Like, you must read this book. It's just like your journey, right? And I remember reading it. And by the way, just a disclaimer, I freaking love Elizabeth Gilbert. Like, I think she's the most wonderful writer. And so this is not at all in any way, shape, or form a jab. But I remember reading the book, and it was an amazing, amazing book. But I felt very like, and then we walked into the sunset and everything was fine, and I married the love of my life. And I remember being frustrated with that ending, because I'm like, I don't relate to this. You know, and I would love to have it, but I just don't relate to it. Like, I am in the freaking mess right now, and I'm just keep going. And I remember that stayed with me. And as I finished my journey, when I completed, like, you know, and I, my journey, quote unquote, completed when I came back to my mom's house in Connecticut and then stepped foot back into New York City. So it was a 9-month journey, even though it unofficially kept going for years to come. But I remember just being like at my mom's house, and I was like, okay, I spent all my savings. I don't, like, I'm kind of making some money, but my coaching career hadn't taken off yet. And I'm like, I feel like a loser right now. I'm like at my mom's house, and I did this whole trip, and it changed my life completely, but I'm exactly where I started, and I don't really know what to do with myself, and I feel very lost. And I kept being like, is this the end? Like, what happened, you know? And I think that's the disorientation. When we look at the hero's journey, a lot of times the hero goes on this grand adventure, and then he resists coming back, or she, you know, she resists coming back home, because back home is basically everything that you left. And there's this moment where you're like, I don't want to come back home. I don't want to come back home. I refuse. And then you realize that you must come back home, because that's how you're going to be able to give the bounty that you collected to the village. But the act of getting back home, like, you know, there's a lot of stories. It's like, it creates depression. And you're like, you know, when I think about the Odyssey and Ulysses comes back home and he's like, oh, are you freaking kidding me? I have to like deal with this freaking mess that happened since I got home. Like, it's not like, yay, party, like, he's back. It's like, oh, like, I have to deal with like all these loose ends and this crap that's happening in my home. And now my wife's being courted. Like, what's going on? You know, and you come back home and you're kind of like, what the F? And there's like a recalibration period where you have to really understand, like, how are you going to bring everything you've become and everything that you are and all the bounty that you've collected, like, how do you actually integrate it back into the not your old life, because you can never go back to that, but back to the life that you're now stabilizing and creating and sharing with the world as well, you know, as part of your bounty that you're here to give. And so I had that moment, and I kept being like, is this the end? Is this the end? Is this the end? And, you know, I won't give away the ending because you got to read it, obviously. But there was a moment where I'm like, what if the – I kept looking for this, like – and then I walked off into the sunset hand in hand with the love of my life, and I married him. And I kept looking for that ending, and that ending didn't come. And there was a moment, though, which I – you know, will be when you read the book. There's a moment where I'm like, wait, this is the ending. And it's so freaking beautiful. And you know, you have the book, so you might know, like, it's so beautiful and unconventional. I'm in love with the ending because it doesn't end the way you think it would end, but it ends the way it needs to end. And it's absolutely perfect for the freaking book. And it also, like, the statement, the share that I wanted to offer to the world is like, hey, sometimes, you know, you finish a chapter and then you close the book and you take a moment and then you just start the next chapter and it's the same book. You're just not done with the book, right? And sometimes you finish the book and then you start a new book that's completely different from the old book. But I wanted to give a different interpretation on how things get to end and how we actually get to transition from one thing to the next without it needing to be this, you know, my book started with me closing a book and starting a completely new book, but it ends with me just changing the chapter, and it's a very special transmission.
Great, great. Now, the last question I have for you is, if someone listening right now is in the middle of their own burning ground with everything falling apart, no clear path, maybe feeling like they are losing themselves, what do you want them to hear?
So the first thing is, there is a map, and this is what I've invested the last decade of my journey, my career, my vocation, studying and, you know, teaching and training and going through these rounds on myself, you know, leading my clients and students through these rounds, which is one of the greatest things that I have found around transitions, is that as a society, we have been so ill prepared to navigate the death, birth, death, and rebirth cycle. We, you know, and this is something that even the ancients, the indigenous, they knew so well, and they talked to their young, and we're missing that these days. which is when you are at the edge of that transition where you know you're going through your burning ground and you know you can't go back. Like, you know it. You can't go back to that relationship. You can't go back to that job. You can't go back to that old life. It's a breaking point and there's like the bridge has been burned. You cannot go back. What I see a lot of people doing is they kind of stand at this threshold and they're looking at this, everything that's burning behind them. But then they're looking at this abyss in front of them and they freeze or they're like, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. And then they start telling themselves a story. I'm lost. I don't know what to do. And this is a moment in between the fire and the darkness where all of the demons come out, the old identity. But no, I'm not, but I'm somebody who does this, right? Like I am, insert police system, but I am from this country, but I am a tech person, but I am a relationship person, but I am this. I can't do that. And it's a moment where all your demons come out. They all come out to play. Your fears, your belief systems, your conditioning. And a lot of people, they stay stuck in that moment. But actually, what you need to do is you need to keep walking forward and reckon with those demons, reckon with the police, reckon with the identity, because they can't actually eat you. And, you know, the fear, the greatest thing we have to fear is fear itself. And so when we actually start to understand that transformation is a cycle and it moves in phases, which is actually what, you know, the Burning Ground, the book is a story, but it's also a compass. It walks you through this compass that I've developed in storytelling form, which is the first step is really shedding the past, right? That's like allowing the ground to burn and saying, I am going to step out of the past story. That's phase one. But phase two is reckoning with your fears. That is traditionally is the medicine of the jaguar. It's actually having the courage to walk into and out through the greatest fears that you have faced. And that's going to require people to have the hard conversations. It's going to require you to, you know, more practically speaking, ask for the divorce, if that's what it is. It's going to require you to face the grief of that person's death. Instead of avoiding it or numbing it or distracting from it, it's going to require you to put in your notice and be comfortable with the void of not knowing what the next job is going to look like or not knowing whether your entrepreneurial venture is actually going to take off. It's being able to, it's developing the capacity and the muscle to sit with that discomfort the same way that when you go to the gym, you have to build up to being able to carry a certain amount of weight. You're going to have to strain your muscles. You're going to have to recover. You're going to have to eat nutrients for your muscles to repair. It's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be sore. It's like that, but emotionally and spiritually. That's phase two. And that's the really like sticky, icky. That's the one that most people don't make it through because they don't believe they can, right? And this is the part where we need coaching and mentorship and support so we can just get through the freaking last mile. You know, when you're in the climbing the Himalayas and you're in the last mile, and you've got your guide, it's like that last mile is the freaking hardest before you reach the summit. Because phase three, when you actually are able to walk through those layers and those fears and you're able to reckon with them, what happens on the other side of that is that you come into deeper remembrance of what your gifts are. When you're able to overcome your fear and you stop focusing on your fears and your old identity, that energy gets redistributed in who you're here to be. So you have mind space and you have bandwidth mentally and emotionally and spiritually to start thinking about, oh my God, you know what? I am a talented artist. Let me paint more. Or you know what? I am really good speaking with people. Let me do that. Oh my God, you know what? Because of my ability to process the grief that I've gone through, I understand people's griefs. Let me help them through that because I'm not so busy trying to get myself out of the hole, right? So it creates a space, phase three, for us to really be able to come into contact with our gifts and to be able to hear our soul's guidance. So phase three is about sipping the sweet nectar of life and actually being able to come into deeper joy of who we are here to be, which then takes us into phase four, because when we're able to connect to our gifts and we're able to actually practice them and have the space to give them to people, phase four is what we're really here to create, which is we're here to contribute to the collective. So this is the part where we have enough knowing of our gifts and we stop doubting our gifts that we're actually able to freely give them to others. And this is where we give the bounty to the village, and we give, this is where, you know, for me, it was my coaching career, and I start developing my frameworks, and I'm able to create courses and programs, which obviously also has a financial retribution, you know, and so this is where people actually, we get to be part of the village, not as somebody who's in the village asking, am I okay? Do I have enough food? Is everything good? But we transition into the space of functional adulthood where we can ask the question, what does the village need right now, and provide that for the world. And so, and then phase four, and then guess what happens? Guess what happens, Robert? You have your phase four, and then boom, you hit a place where you outgrow phase four, and you're in phase one all over again. Grr, right? and so a lot of people, they ride the cycle, kind of like they let the cycle happen to them, and they kind of like struggle, and then something, you know, God intervenes and something great happens, and they're like, yay, I'm okay again. Life is amazing. Let's go up, 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 upwards we go. And then they think they crash, and then they're like, oh, fuck, what happened to my life? It was so good, right? And they kind of live a life at cause of these cycles. But what I'm suggesting to anyone who's listening is that transition is part of our human condition. And if we're able to actually get on the ride and be like, ooh, excellent. Mm-hmm. I'm in phase four of my life right now. Let me give everything that I can. And let me just freaking, like, you know, squeeze the lemon for the lemonade in this phase. And the same thing with phase two. Let me just freaking go in onto my fears and reckon with them. Let's go, you know, because eventually a different phase, like just like the seasons, winter is here, spring will come. And when it's springtime, that's enough. That's enough navel gazing. It's time for you to go and, like, you know, reap the flowers. So if we can actually self-identify where we are on this map of transformation, we can navigate it more gracefully. And you realize that you're not lost. After the burning ground, you're not lost. You're just entering phase two of your transformation, and roll up your sleeves and go into it, because the faster you do that, the more gracefully you're going to pop out on the other side with a deeper knowing of your gifts. So let's go. It's uncomfortable. It's scary. It's annoying. But know that there are gifts on the other side of you reckoning with yourself in that way. So that's what I would say. Follow
the map. Perfect. Well, Celine, this has really been a treat. I really want to thank you for your time and talking to us. It's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful message that you have for those.
Yes. Thank you so much for the wonderful questions. They were really delightful to answer.
You're very welcome. Again, today, my special guest has been Celine DaCosta, author of The Burning Ground, One Woman's Journey to Reclaim Her Soul and Ignite Her Fire. And again, you can find out more by visiting Celine's website, which is CelineDaCosta.com. And that's CelineDaCosta.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.